They sat together in darkness, close together as though for comfort, and Mark had not lit the lantern. The reflected glow of stars was thrown in under the thatched veranda of the cottage, giving them just enough light to make out each other's faces. "We knew it was coming," whispered Storm, "and yet somehow I did not believe it, just as though wishing could make it stop." "I am going through early tomorrow to see your father," Mark told her. "He has to know." She nodded. "Yes. We must be ready to confront them."
"What will you do? I can't leave you here with John."
"And you can't take me with you. Not to my father," she agreed. "It's all right, Mark. I'll take John back to the cottage. We'll wait for you." "I'll come for you there, and next time we return, you'll be my wife." She leaned against him. "If there's anything to return to," she whispered. "Oh, Mark, Mark, they can't do it. They can't drown all this.
The words eluded her, and she fell silent, clinging to him. They did not speak again until minutes later a low, polite cough roused them, and Mark straightened to see the dark, familiar bulk of Pungushi standing below the veranda in the starlight.
"Pungushi," he said. "I see you."
"Ejamela," the Zulu replied,
and there was a tone and tightness in his voice that Mark had never heard before.
"I have been to the camp of the strangers, the cutters of wood, the men with painted poles and bright axes."
He turned his head to look down the valley, and they followed his gaze. The ruddy glow of many campfires flickered against the lower slopes of the cliffs, and on the still night air the sounds of laughter and men's voices carried faintly.
"Yes?" Mark asked. "There are two white men there. One of them is young and blind and of no importance, while the other is a square, thick man who stands solid on his feet like a bull buffalo, and yet moves silently and speaks little and quietly."
"Yes?" Mark asked again.
"I have seen this man before in the valley."
Pungushi paused.
"He is the silent one of whom we have spoken. He is the one who shot Ikeku, your grandfather, and smoked as he watched him die."
Hobday moved quietly, solidly, along the edge of the slash line of trees. The axes were silent now, but the end of the noon break would be enforced to the minute. At the stroke of the hour, they would be back at work. He was driving them hard. He always worked his gangs hard, took a pride in his ability to extract from each man effort beyond his wage. It was one of the qualities that Dirk Courtney valued in him. That, and his loyalty. A fierce, unswerving loyalty that balked at no demand upon it. There was no squeamishness, no hesitating. When Dirk Courtney ordered it, there was no question asked. Hobday's reward was every day more apparent. Already he was a man of substance, and when the new land was apportioned, that red, sweet, well-watered soil, rich as newly butchered beef, then his reward would be complete. He paused at the spot where the slope increased sharply, angling into its plunge to the riverbed below, and he looked out across the land. Involuntarily, he licked his lips like a glutton smelling rich food. They had worked so long for this, each of them in his own way, led and inspired by Dirk Courtney, and although Hobday's personal share of the spoil would be a minute fraction of a single percent, yet it was riches such as most other men only dream of. He licked his lips again, standing very still and silent in the shadows, and he looked to the sky. The clouds were piled to the very heavens, mountains of silver, blinding in the sunlight, and as he watched they moved ponderously down on the light wind. He could feel the closeness, and he stirred impatiently. Rain would delay them seriously, and rain was coming, the big torrential summer rains. Then he was distracted again. Something moved on the far side of the slash line, and his eye darted to the movement. It was a flash of bright colour, like the flick of a sunbird's wing, and his veiled eyes jumped to it instantly. His body, without moving, became charged with tension. The girl came out of the brush line and paused 30 paces away. She had not seen him, and she stood poised, listening, head cocked like a forest animal. She stood lightly, gracefully, and her limbs were slim and brown, the flesh so firm and young and sweet that he felt the quick, bright rush of lust again, as he had when, the previous day, he had seen her for the first time. She wore a loose, wide peasant skirt of gay colour, and a thin cotton bodice pulled low at the front and drawn loosely with a string that left the bulge of bosom pushing free, the fine skin shading from dark ruddy brown to pale cream. She was dressed like a girl going to meet a lover, and there was a deliciously fearful tenseness in the way she took a step forward and stopped again uncertainly. He felt the lust fueled in his groin, and he was suddenly aware of his own hoarse breathing. The girl turned her head and looked directly at him, and as she saw him she started visibly, dropping back a pace with one hand flying to her mouth. She stared at him for fully 5 seconds, and then slowly a transformation came over her. The fingers dropped away from her face, and she put both hands behind her back, a movement that thrust the pert breasts against the cotton of her bodice, so he could see the rosy dark buttons of her nipples through the material. She thrust out one hip at a saucy angle and lifted her chin boldly. Deliberately she let her eyes slide down his body, let them linger on his groin, and then rise again to his face. It was an invitation as clear as the spoken word, and Hobday heard the blood roaring in his ears. She tossed her head, flicking the thick braid of hair over her shoulder, and she turned away, walking deliberately back to the tree line, exaggerating the roll of tight round buttocks under the skirt. She looked back over her shoulder, and as he started forward to follow, she let out a tingling flirt of laughter and ran lightly on sandaled feet, turning at an angle down the slope, and Hobday began to run. Within 50 yards, Storm had lost sight of him in the heavy underbrush, and she stopped to listen, fearful that he might have given up the pursuit. And then there was movement above her, at the crest of the slope, and she realized with the first pang of real alarm that he had moved more swiftly than she had anticipated, and he had not followed her down, but had stayed above her in a position of command. She went off again, running, and almost immediately she realized that he was ahead of her, moving fast along the crest. From up there he could trap her by a swift turn directly down the slope. She felt panic spur her, and started to run in earnest. Immediately the loose scree betrayed her, and slipped away under her feet. She fell and rolled, flailing her arms for support, and coming up on her knees the moment her fall was broken. She let out a little sob of fear. The man had seen her fall and had come down the slope. He was so close that she could see the square white teeth in the brown, smooth face. He was grinning, a keen, excited grimace, and he was steady and quick, moving down directly into the path along which she must run to safety, cutting her off squarely from where Mark waited. She jumped to her feet and swirled away, doubling the slope, instinctively turning directly away from her pursuer and from all help. Suddenly she was completely alone, fleeing on frantic feet into the lonely spaces of the bush, beyond earshot of succour. Mark had been right, she realized. He had not wanted her to act as the bait. He had known just how dangerous a game she had set out to play, but in her stubborn, arrogant way she had insisted, laughing at his protests, belittling his fears, until he had reluctantly agreed. Now she was running terrified, the terror making her heart pound, and squeezing her lungs so that her legs felt weak and rubbery under her. Once she tried to turn back, but like an old and wily hound coursing a hare, he had anticipated and was there to block her. Again she ran, and suddenly the river was in front of her. The upcountry rains had spated the course of the Bubezi, and it rolled past in wide green majesty. She had to turn again along the bank, and was immediately into the area of thick jesse bush. The heavy thorn crowded her closely, leaving only narrow passages, a labyrinth of dark and secret twists and turns, in which almost immediately she lost direction. She stopped and stood, trying to listen over the rush of her own breathing, trying to see through the wavering mist of her tears, tears of fear and of helplessness. Her hair had come down in little wisps over her forehead, her cheeks blazed with high colour, and the tears made her eyes glitter with a feverish sheen. She heard nothing, and the brown thorn encircled her. She turned slowly, almost like a blind woman, and now she was sobbing softly in her terror. She chose one of the narrow passages for escape and dived into it. He was waiting for her. She came round the first twist of the pathway and ran almost directly into his chest. Only at the very last instant she saw the outstretched arms, thick and brown and smooth, with the fingers of both hands hooked to seize her. She screamed, high and shrill, and spun away, back along the path she had come, but his fingers caught in the thin cotton of her blouse. It tore like paper, and as she ran, the smooth, creamy flesh of her back shone through the rent, flashing with a pearly promise that spurred his lust even higher. And when he laughed, it was a hoarse, breathless blurt of sound that launched Storm into a fresh paroxysm of terror. He hunted her through the jesse, and twice, when he could have taken her, he deliberately let her slip through his fingers, drawing out the excruciating pleasure of it, cat with mouse, delighting at the way she shrieked at his touch and at the fresh outburst of frantic terror with which she tried to escape him. But at last she was finished, and she backed up into a corner of solid, impenetrable thorn wall and crouched there, clutching the shreds of her torn blouse around her, trembling with the wild, uncontrollable shudders of a patient in high fever, her face smeared with tears and her sweat staring at him with huge, dark blue eyes. He came slowly to her. He stooped, and she was unresisting as he placed his big, square, brown hands on her shoulders. He was still chuckling, but his own breath was unsteady, and his lips were drawn back from the square white teeth in a grimace of lust and excitement. He pressed his mouth down over hers, and it was like one of those nightmares in which she could not move nor scream. His teeth crushed painfully against her lips, and she tasted her own blood, a slick metallic salt on her tongue, and she felt herself suffocating. His hands were hard and rough as granite on the soft silk of her breasts, and she came to life again, tugging unavailingly at his wrists, trying to drag them away. "Yes," he grunted, in the soft, thick, choked voice. "Fight! Keep fighting me, yes. Yes, that's right. Struggle! Don't stop!" His voice roused her from the hypnotic spell of terror, and she screamed again. "Yes," he said. "Do that. Scream again." And he turned her across his body, forcing her down until his knee caught her in the small of the back, and her body bent backwards like a drawn bow, her hair sweeping the ground, and the curve of her throat was soft and white and vulnerable. He placed his open mouth on her throat. She was pinned helplessly as with one hand he swept the wide peasant skirt up above her waist. "Scream," he whispered gutturally. "Scream again." And with complete and horrified disbelief, she felt those thick brown fingers, calloused and deliberately cruel, begin to prise open her body. They seemed to tear her tenderest, most secret flesh like the talons of an eagle. And she screamed and screamed. Mark had lost them in the labyrinthine maze of the jesse bush, and there had been silence now for many minutes. He stood bareheaded and panting, listening with every fibre of his being in the aching silence of the jesse thorn. His eyes were wild, and he hated himself with bitter venom for letting himself be persuaded by Storm. He had known how dangerous this man was. He was a killer, a coldly competent killer, and he had sent a girl, a young and tender girl, to bait him. Then Storm screamed, close by in the jesse, and with a violent lift of savage relief, Mark began to run again. At the last moment, Hobday heard him coming, and he dropped Storm's slim, abused body, and turned with unbelievable speed, dropping into the crouch of a heavyweight prize fighter, solid and low behind lifted arms and hunched shoulders, thick and rubbery with muscle. Mark swung the weapon he had made the night before, a long sausage of rawhide, the seams double-sewn, and then filled with lead buckshot. It weighed 2 pounds, and it made a sound through the air like the wings of a wild duck, and he swung full-armed, the blow given power and weight by his terrible anger and hatred. Hobday threw up his right arm to catch the blow. The bones of his forearm broke cleanly with a sharp crackle, but still the force of the blow was not fully expended, and the leaded bag flew on, directly into Hobday's face. Had he not caught the full weight of it on his arm, the blow would have killed him. As it was, his face seemed to collapse, and his head snapped backwards to the full stretch of his neck. Hobday crashed backwards into the wall of jesse, and the curved red-tipped thorns caught in his clothing and flesh and held him there, sprawling like a boneless doll, arms outspread, legs dangling, his face hanging forward on his chest, and the thick dark droplets of blood beginning to fall onto his shirt and roll softly downwards across his belly, leaving wet crimson lines down the khaki drill.